I'm Brian Curtis.
And I'm Wendy Ring. Welcome to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. Half of U.S. households can't put solar panels on their roofs because they're renters, their roofs are unfit due to orientation, shade, and weight-bearing capacity, or because they just can't afford it.
But community solar provides a way for those folks to get the benefit of solar energy and lower bills as well.
The most common form of community solar is when a utility or solar developer puts up a solar farm and signs up community members as subscribers who get credit for that energy on their electric bills.
Since new solar is now around 30% cheaper than fossil fuel power plants, subscribers get power at a 5 to 10% discount. But most of the savings leave the community as profit for the owners and investors.
It doesn't have to be that way. Communities can build and own their own solar.
We've got stories for you from the Pacific Northwest about folks doing just that.
Like the Hummingbird Project in Olympia, Washington.
It could have been named after another bird, the phoenix, rising as it did from the ashes of defeat.
It was 2018, and Washington State had a carbon tax on the ballot for the second time after a previous initiative failed in 2016. Supported by a broad coalition, including tribes, environmental groups, health advocates, and labor unions, the $15 per ton tax would go toward renewable energy and transitioning displaced workers.
Mason Rolfe, a recent graduate of Evergreen College, and some of his friends and former classmates worked tirelessly on the campaign. But despite financial backing from billionaires Tom Steyer, Michael Bloomberg, and Bill Gates, they were outspent 2-1 by big oil.
It became the most expensive ballot initiative fight in Washington history, so we lost, and it was really disappointing.
Mason and local campaigners were sitting in someone's living room, licking their wounds, and trying to decide what to do next.
It was myself, one of the local campaign organizers for the ballot initiative, and a couple friends from college. We really wanted to find a way that we could not only like talk about climate change, but actually see something get done. I had been looking into community solar for a long time and proposed that as an idea, and our little group formed up to pursue a project.
And that's how Project Hummingbird was born. The name was inspired by a story from the Quechua people of South America.
There's this huge wildfire burning through the forest. And as it consumes the forest, all the woodland animals are running from their homes and trying to seek shelter by a lake. They're sitting there bemoaning the loss of their homes, and out of the woods comes flitting a little tiny hummingbird. And the hummingbird goes right into the water, picks up a little drop of water, and flies off back into the woods. And it comes back and does it again and does it again, and all the other animals are saying, "Little hummingbird, what are you doing? This fire is so big. And your beak is so small, what could you be thinking to try to drop water on the fire?" And without even pausing, the hummingbird says to them, "I'm doing what I can."
The group's first task was finding a location. They set their sights on the 9,000 square foot roof of Olympia's Hands-On Children's Museum.
The museum had a brand new metal roof, so it was perfect.
We made presentations to their board, convinced them to work with us, even though we were just a group of millennials.
But when they got to the point of contracting for the use of the roof, being a group of millennials wasn't enough. The museum said,
"We can't just work with a random community group. We need an organization." And so our team packaged together the whole project information into this big proposal, and we pitched it to a local nonprofit that works on climate issues. And they said that they would not sponsor the project because they didn't feel it was economically viable. This is a climate-focused nonprofit. And I'm like, guys, it doesn't matter what it's going to pay out. It matters is that we reduce emissions immediately.
It was youthful urgency meets old guard greenies.
It was certainly a different generation. Their board was all older folks. Our team wanted to take on physical local projects, and this nonprofit was more focused on incremental policy change. So the day after we heard the news that they would not sponsor the project, we went and incorporated Olympia Community Solar. After we secured the partnership with the museum to use their rooftop, our team put together a solar request for proposal. So we put all the information about the museum, its building plans, its energy consumption history, our goals for the project into a document and sent that around to every solar installer we could find in the area. We received proposals from four different installers, and we reviewed them for the equipment quality and warranties, the installer's reputation and history. We also considered the price and what we thought we could fundraise for.
About that fundraising, doing community solar in Washington requires creativity.
Washington State does not have a community solar policy that allows us to put energy credits directly onto subscribers' bills. There are some utilities doing voluntary utility-owned community solar and doing virtual net metering that way. But when we approach the utility asking to provide that service for our third-party-owned project, they'll refuse.
So Mason's group created this workaround where they put their solar projects on local nonprofit and government buildings. Mason talks about community members owning the panels, but it's more accurate to say they're lending Olympia Community Solar the money for the project in loans that come in solar panel-sized tranches. The nonprofit host uses the energy generated on its rooftop and pays Olympia Community Solar for that power at a lower rate than the local utility. The proceeds from the energy sales are distributed back to the lenders until all the project costs have been recovered.
Once the investors have been repaid, Olympia Community Solar donates the solar installation to the nonprofit host. The biggest thing most people in their early 20s buy is a car, and generally a used one at that. These young activists were taking on the purchase of a 298-panel solar installation.
You know, it was really kind of scary looking at a $230,000 solar contract and thinking we could fund that was a huge question. We were really putting ourselves out there as a new organization. We didn't know if subscriptions were going to sell, but to secure all the partnerships, to have people sign up, you got to project the confidence that we're going to get it done. And one of the ways we did that was we would publish enrollment reports on our social media and on our website showing how far along the campaign we are, how many subscribers we have. And I think that really helped people feel like they're participating in a community effort rather than just, you know, sending money off to who knows where. The moment that I realized that we might be able to do it was about a week after we opened enrollment. I went and checked the mailbox, and there's about 24 envelopes with participant checks in there. And I sat on the floor of my room, didn't even have an office at this point,
and I opened them one by one. And it was really the first moment when I thought the project would be possible. And also really the moment I realized we had a responsibility to build the project for all of these folks that were relying on us to do it. And so it was the moment where I thought we could do it, and then also the moment when I knew we had to do it.
That was February 2020. 3 weeks later, the pandemic hit.
That really forced us to switch gears from our initial plan of doing tons of community outreach, enrolling people in person, to investing some money in a really nice website and setting up a whole online enrollment portal.
Local investment in the project just kept coming.
97 participants now own a portion of its generation. The smallest participant owns about a half of one of the solar panels, and the largest participant owns about 60 of them.
That largest owner turned out to be the museum itself.
We invited the Children's Museum to be a nonprofit participant themselves. And community members had the opportunity to donate subscriptions to benefit the Children's Museum. So they actually ended up being the single largest subscriber of the project. Once we collect all that energy revenue after paying for expenses like insurance and cleaning the project, a big portion of it goes right back into their operating funds. Once we realized that that was an awesome approach to getting subscriptions donated and supporting the Children's Museum, we invited other local nonprofits to sign up, and we ended up having 14 local nonprofits participating in the project, and they ended up owning more than 60% of the project's capacity. So it's actually a majority nonprofit-owned project.
Some of the money to build the projects also came from grants.
Right towards the end, we had a really scary thing happen. I didn't know it at the time because I was so new to the industry, but one of the big grants we received for like $60,000 was reimbursement based. So we had to spend $60,000 and then they would pay out the reimbursement. And we did not have $60,000 in the bank account. So I actually ended up going to one of our biggest supporters of the project and asked them for a short-term loan, and they fronted $40,000 to help us pay the upfront costs. Yeah, without that person, it really couldn't have happened.
The Hummingbird Project went live in February 2021.
Both the Children's Museum and the Farmers Market are right in downtown Olympia, and so when I head to our office, I get to drive past the systems, and I am so proud to see them up on the rooftops. And also, for Western Washington, our industry is very new. So to see solar arrays of this size is really rare. And so I'm really proud that other people will see it, know that it's working, know that, yes, even though we're one of the rainiest parts of the country, we can still have real economic benefits from solar. We're working on projects all over Washington State now, in the San Juan Islands, over on the east side of the state, and that's super exciting, and I'm looking forward to traveling to those communities and seeing, just like here in Olympia, the solar excitement blossom from each new project.
Aside from the good these projects do for their communities and for the planet, Mason says they're good for his mental health.
As soon as I kind of start getting tied up in those bigger issues that I can't control, that's when I start feeling the climate despair or the eco grief, you might say. If I focus on the local things that I can control, it feels really, really positive. And so my approach has just been focus on local projects, focus on getting one thing done at a time. And that's really helped my mental health and being able to continue the work.
Doing community solar has gotten easier since Mason's group blazed the trail. There's so much grant funding available that raising money from community members often isn't necessary.
For a lot of our projects now, we're not even using the community funding model. We're just launching grant application after grant application. And there is tons of funding out there. You find a partner who's willing to work with you to install solar, preferably a nonprofit or a public entity or a tribe. And you help them get through the quoting process and select a quote that's going to work for them. And then our team, we take the quotes and use them to apply for grants. And usually all it takes is an example of a past grant that the applicant has received, plus the solar proposal, and then, you know, some grant writing wizardry. And the partners end up with a solar installation they don't have to pay for.
The Inflation Reduction Act is also a game changer for community solar. In addition to raising the solar tax credit back to 30% of cost for individuals and businesses, the act will use federal dollars to pay the same amount to nonprofits and local governments. With added credits for projects located on brownfields or tribal land or dedicated to serving low-income communities, developers of community solar projects can now be reimbursed for as much as half the cost. That means now is a great time to start a nonprofit and solarize your community.
Mason's group has resources that can help you get your project off the ground.
Check out our webpage. It's olysol.org. That's OLYSOL.org. We are happy to provide sample documents, whether it be our sample request for proposal, sample grant applications, sample lease agreements, community solar participation agreements. Just write us an email and I'd be happy to share that stuff.
The Hummingbird Project wasn't the first of its kind. The Oregon Clean Power Cooperative had been using a similar model to install solar on public and community buildings for several years.
Right around the time Mason and his friends were licking their political wounds in northern Washington, the co-op was putting up a solar project on the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. OSF, as it's known to locals, is one of the oldest and largest nonprofit theater companies in the U.S.
Like other performing arts venues, they'd been hit hard by the pandemic.
Dan Orzek is the Oregon Co-op's general manager.
They were dark for more than a year during the pandemic. They didn't have money for solar. There was no way they were going to do solar if the community had not stepped up and put up the money.
While the theater is located in the more upscale town of Ashland, the panels were going up on the theater's production building in nearby Talent, a town of 6,000, home to a mixture of theater folks, farm workers, and retirees. That's where Dan met a local guy named Ray.
My name is Ray Sanchez Pescador. I'm a retired scientist. I was putzing around for 5 years, and in 2016, attended a seminar that Sustainable Northwest and Rogue Climate put together about clean renewable energy in Lake County and said, ah, this is how I want to spend my retirement time.
Ray joined a group called Solarize Rogue, which was helping to bring clean energy to the Rogue River Valley.
After Oregon passed community solar legislation requiring utilities to connect with independent solar projects and give participants credit on their electric bills, Ray wanted to bring community solar to Talent.
We started talking to people, and what we found out was that people were interested in owning their systems. They were not necessarily interested in just buying energy from a large solar farm. They said, no, no, we want ownership. We want our own stuff. And so that's why we developed the model that we did.
Most community solar in the U.S. has very little to do with community.
Somebody with a lot of money builds a large system. They own the system, and then they simply sell the energy to Oregon residents. So the residents are buying clean energy, but they don't have any ownership over the system.
Solarize Rogue wanted to do something different, build a solar installation where each panel or groups of panels would be owned by different community members.
We wanted to make sure that the community owned the system, so the community can actually make decisions, and B, the money that's not spent by paying a large utility and leaving the community could be spent locally now.
Even though he didn't know anything about the technical or business side of solar, Ray was confident he could manage such a project.
I've managed large mergers and acquisitions before, so millions of dollars of project costs don't scare me, and very, very complex projects don't scare me. So it's like, yeah, we can do this.
When Ray heard about the cooperative's project at OSF, he reached out to Dan.
I was curious but skeptical.
I just said, how can you not see this? This is a great opportunity. Trust me, it's going to work.
We ran the numbers in spreadsheets and reran them and reran them again and realized that it was a viable model.
OSF had plenty of unused roof space, and they said, come on up.
Recruiting Dan and finding the site turned out to be the easy part.
The community solar program designed by the state's Public Utility Commission had some improvements over earlier programs in states that were early adopters. Community solar projects in those states ended up being built almost exclusively by large for-profit solar developers, with the lower-cost solar energy going to big businesses.
Oregon learned from those early mistakes. In Oregon's community solar program, half the subscribers in each project have to be residential. 10% must be low-income residents receiving a 40% discount. And a quarter of all community solar megawatts are reserved for government and nonprofit projects.
But the procedures for bringing projects online were designed for large corporate developers.
If you're a big commercial solar developer, you have banking relationships established typically, or investor relationships, and you go to them and you say, I have a project, I need $5 million for it. The challenge for community-based groups is, where do you get that money up front?
The rules didn't allow for the way community projects raise money.
You couldn't contact potential consumers until after the system was what's called pre-certified, gone through the regulatory process with the state. But in order for you to go through that, you have to tell them exactly what you're going to build, where you're going to build it, and everything else.
That works fine for the big developers.
They say, okay, we're going to build a 1 megawatt system. And then they build it and they sell the energy to somebody else, right? It's like the movie, build it and they will come. Well, here comes Ray with his own little Solarize Rogue project and says, well, we don't know what we're going to build. We're only going to build as much money as we have. But the process wouldn't allow us to talk to people beforehand. So how would we know what it was that we were going to build if we were not supposed to talk to people to find out what we could build?
Although we're talking about a small town here, 6,000 people, you know they're going to talk, no matter what the PUC says.
Of course.
But talk is cheap. They still needed to have the money in hand.
It was a challenge to get the PUC to allow us to get people's money before we actually got into the full regulatory process. Being that this is the first time that we had ever done this, we decided to start with saying, well, we're just going to build a 25 kilowatt system. That's the smallest system you can build and still be called a community solar, because we were pretty much petrified at the prospect of this large project. And we set ourselves a stretch goal of 60 kilowatts and say, hey, we'll feel really, really good if we can do 60 kilowatts. So that means we were going to sign up 2 or 3 people versus maybe 6. If we can sign 6 people, we're going to be feeling really, really good.
In the end, the size of the project exceeded all expectations.
We signed 16 in 2 or 3 weeks, and we had to stop because we ran out of roof space.
The participants were a good cross-section of the local population, including farmers, residents of retirement community, and two low-income families who did not buy panels but signed up to receive bill credits at a discount.
The project hit another bump when it came to connecting up with the utility.
While the community solar program allowed for projects as small as 25 kilowatts, the utility treated them all like big power plants.
Pacific Power was used to connecting multi-million dollar, multi-megawatt projects to the grid. And so they took the same equipment requirements and applied it to this tiny project.
We had to comply with the same requirements as huge, massive coal or gas power plants.
Ray negotiated with the utility to downscale their requirements.
We had to outsource to an equipment company to build for us because this piece of equipment for a project is small. It doesn't exist. We were very fortunate that the Energy Trust of Oregon helped pay for that piece of equipment that we had not anticipated. For us, tiny little solarized rogue talking with monster Pacific Power was not very comfortable at many times.
Ray was a bulldog, which is what it took because it was really paving new ground.
You know, I used to have more hair.
For Ray, bringing this little solar project to life turned out to be much harder than orchestrating a major merger and acquisition. And he learned that a project costing hundreds of thousands of dollars can be way more stressful than one that costs millions when the money is your neighbor's.
Solarize Rogue's community solar system went online in March of 2022.
When the switch was finally flipped on, I was so relieved because it had been 2 years of angst, really. I did not feel comfortable with having invested other people's monies. So it was a huge relief to me when I first saw on the website that the system was actually starting to produce energy. Phew. The participants are thrilled. Many people would just simply say, that's sunk money. It's gone. I mean, I've already spent it. It's not like I'm a financing expert or whatnot. It left my checking account. It's gone. So from now on, my energy is free. How cool is that? The participants are sending me copies of their bills with a big zero on them. They're very, very excited, and they can't wait to tell their friends about new upcoming projects. And this is also true for the two low-income families. They can't wait to tell their friends, their neighbors, their relatives, anybody else that they can when a new project opens up to sign up for it. To date, we are one of only three community solar projects that are live in the state of Oregon. And we are the only participant-owned project in the state so far, but hopefully we're going to change that. Now that we've gone through the Oregon Public Utility Commissions, the utility company, we now know how to do this. And so we're moving forward to build more of these.
Solarize Rogue and the Oregon Clean Power Cooperative are collaborating on new projects that extend beyond the Rogue Valley to the utility's entire service area. And while their first project was just 140 kilowatts, these new projects are 1 megawatt.
One project they're exploring close to home is on a closed landfill that would provide power for the town of Talent, which is still recovering from a 2020 wildfire.
We lost about half of our houses, and a lot of those were low-income housing. And so the city has been struggling for the last 2 years to bring citizens back into town. And so one of the things that we thought we could help the city with is to provide the energy from the system to low-income families. This would be a subscriber-based project with a dedicated focus on providing energy for low-income families. It's one of my favorite projects, you know, to be able to help the city recover.
Community solar can provide solar access to low-income people because it's less expensive than residential solar. The OSF project costs 30% less than putting the same panels on people's homes.
Because of economies of scale, the cost on a per watt basis comes down. The larger the system, the more inexpensive it gets.
Solarize Rogue and the co-op are working together on another participant-owned project with an irrigation district in South Central Oregon.
Southern Oregon is, like a lot of the West, in the middle of a major drought, and we're working with local irrigation districts where the members haven't gotten water allocations for years in some cases.
With farms unable to grow hay, ranchers have to cull their livestock.
Or they used to be able to lease it to someone who was grazing, you know, 100 head of cattle on it, and now they can only do 20 because that's all the grass will support. Those ranchers and farmers are in danger of going out of business, losing their land, and every penny that they can save on electric bills helps.
The system will provide power for 400 homes.
As we'll learn in our next episode, farming and solar need not be exclusive. Promising research on agrivoltaics is taking place across the country, and the co-op is collaborating with Oregon State University's College of Agriculture on another community solar project where researchers will study how farming and solar can best work together. There's a lot of anti-solar backlash in rural America these days, but community solar has gotten a good reception in rural and conservative southern Oregon.
There's a big difference between a large out-of-state solar developer who wants to come in and take 500 or 1,000 acres of your local farmland to put up solar where the profits go, who knows where, out of state. There's a big difference between that and a community-based project where you live across the street or down the road and you own those panels, or you have invested directly in that project on your church or a local nonprofit or your kid's school.
Local attitudes towards solar depend a lot on how you frame it.
When you have conversations with folks about solar energy, if you position it around climate change in Southern Oregon, you're in a losing battle. However, nobody is against saving money. And so if you position it as, well, it's going to cost you a little bit of money, but then from that point forward, your energy is free. Free is something that people really like to hear. And so, well, tell me more about that. And how does this work? What do I need to do? And hey, can I tell my neighbor? Absolutely. And so it's a different conversation.
Just like Mason's experience up in Washington, there's also an element of seeing is believing. Visible solar that serves the community inspires the desire to do more.
We keep getting phone calls from people not only who want to participate in one of these projects, but from people who bring us different ideas. It's really starting to germinate and trigger people's imagination as to what we can do.
Solar energy has been so much of a focal point of the media and the climate drama that it seems like this futuristic, magical technology, when really it's just an expensive appliance you stick on a roof. And anybody, if you put the time and effort into learning how it works and how to fund a solar project, can make them happen. And so if you're listening to this and you want to work on a local solar project, go find a partner, get quotes from installers, and then start applying for grants, and you will be amazed at what you can do.
You've been listening to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up.
Thanks to Mason Rolfe, Dan Orzek, and Ray Sanchez-Pescador for sharing their stories, and to Scott Holmes, Mark Apechua, Josh Woodward, and Silent Partner for our music.